You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad. Well, hello and welcome to the 11th episode of the Adoption Fostering Podcast. And this week we're going to be talking to Jane Pickthall from Navash. So, hello Scott, how are you?
I'm good. Well, I'm all right, Al. How are you? I noticed you called us a podcast. Is that right? Have we changed it to a podcast from podcast?
Yeah, it's an edict that came out from the government. There's no more podcasts. They're all podcasts. Yeah. Honestly.
Yeah, not bad. How are you?
I'm okay. I feel like it's been the busiest few weeks of my entire adult life. I don't know about you, but it's crazy.
It has gone a bit bonkers. Yeah. I thought January was mad, but the end of February just went absolutely completely off its things.
Quickly moving on.
So,
it feels really odd. There's a lot of stuff going on, and I'm aware of, I know for you, there's changes within the organisation. It just seems like it seems like we're in this period of just hard work, where there's lots of issues bubbling along.
Yeah.
And like the Adoption Support Fund, the Fair Access Limit, CPV, mental health, schools.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work going on.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and then on the other side, on my side, we've got single adopters. We've got some kind of stuff coming up with parents of older teens and adopted adults. And the similar kind of thing to you. Once you get so entrenched in this work, you tend not to be able to get out of it, don't you?
It's interesting because a friend of mine said to me the other day, she said, "Are you looking after yourself?" And I'm not. But it was really in relation to some of the stuff that people have been contacting me with around CPV, child parent violence. And there was a day a couple of weeks ago where people had been downloading the report that Dr. T had been doing, and they leave reasons why they've downloaded, and the reasons were just heartrending, and I just sat on me thinking, so far to go, so far to go.
Yeah, there definitely is.
Do
but
you get
I've
that?
Heard that, yeah, I do, yeah, all the time. It's just, and I think when I to be perfectly honest, I think when things aren't quite right with our own families as well, we probably feel it a little bit more. When we're chipper and we're up and things are going reasonably all right, or as reasonably all right as we can expect them to be, I think that we can sometimes rise above it. But sometimes when you're below that kind of that place, it can affect you a little bit more than it would normally. That's my...
Yeah. And it feels like your family, I don't know about your family life, well, I do know about your family life, but it feels like it comes in waves where you feel like you're just getting your head above, and then another one rolls over you. Joys of parenting.
I know, exactly. So, but I always rely on two things, humour.
Yes.
And the support that I get from other adopters, because that has been very key for me the last week, 2 weeks. And I don't think without either of those, I'd probably be doing this up. And I don't mean to bring it down in tone, but humour is hugely important, as is the support of our own people. I make us sound like some aliens, and I suppose in some ways we are, but it's really key for me to be able to kind of keep above it, keep going.
I mean, I think there's just that common language in that, you can raise your eyebrow. Your child does something, you raise your eyebrow. And if someone knows and understands, you shortcut all of that. You just go, yeah, we get it. We get it. Invaluable just having friends.
Yeah. Hugely.
Cool.
Yeah. But I know.
Excellent. Well,
it'll soon be summer.
It will soon be summer, and we can argue in the sunshine instead with our children.
Exactly. So exactly. At least we'll be outside.
At least, it's good. Hey, and it's good to see that the on another positive note, it's good to see that the adoption social's kind of coming back to life. That's good news.
Yeah.
That makes
me is good news, and it actually pleased me to see that as well, because I think that I missed that. I've gone kind of quiet, but I think I had really missed just being able to to go to one place. I know there's other places, but I like their setup. It really fits me, fits what I need, how I access it.
I think they've got a unique and I think voice.
They definitely have. Yeah, and I think the one that that there's another two sprouted up, hasn't there? There's one for single adopters and there's one for bad dads. I don't think that's aimed for it, but what does the BAD stand for?
Blogs for adoptive dads.
Yes.
Bad Blinky.
So those two set up. I know of another one that's going to set up very short.
Do you? Pray tell. Share with the group.
There's one.
Wow.
Well, the thing is, right? Yeah. It's a bit like the podcast.
Yeah.
Because I've noticed a few podcasts springing up all over the place since we started ours, and I think that if I share this news about this place for other blogs, that someone's going to rob it before I get to actually do it.
My lips are sealed. Just tell me, no one will know. You know, I'll go and do it.
That's true. I mean, I think, yeah, you would as well. Just despite, I think it's really good. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed the comments come out. They've kind of sprung up, and that's not to say that they've copied us. I mean, my good God, I wouldn't flatter ourselves by saying
it's just coincidental.
But I do think that some of them may have come from as a result of us springing up with our 10 episodes. You know, of fabulous interviewees and banter and, useful information.
And we are the home of adoption banter. That's who we are.
We are. And that is very true. And you know what? We've only done it with two that I know of, people that or persons or listeners who haven't necessarily enjoyed our witty banter. But the premise of this was always about providing a little lift to adoptive parents' life. And that, for me, is what's key. Because I don't think we would do it otherwise between the two of us. Because I don't think if we couldn't have the banter, I don't think I probably wouldn't do it. You probably would, but it was your idea in the first place. So
no, I just think that it hopefully just provide a little bit of a laugh. And honestly, if you can laugh at yourself, you'll always be happy. So there you go.
Well,
anyway, let's get on with the show.
I laugh at you quite often. So,
you do. Yeah. My five-year-old makes fun of me, my accent. When she's five, she goes, "Stop."
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
It's very wrong. Anyway. Well, on the day of Storm Doris racing across the land, I went down and I met Jane Pickthall, who is the incoming chair of the National Association of Virtual Heads, and had an interview with her. So I'll put the interview on and then we shall have a little chit-chat at the end. Is that okay?
Yes, we shall.
Excellent. Okay, well, today I'm speaking to Jane Pickthall, who is a practicing virtual school head. So, hello, Jane.
Hello. Al.
Hello. Thank you very much for letting me speak to you. It's really appreciated. Could you give a brief explanation of who you are, what you do?
Yes, I've been working with looked after children's education for nearly 17 years. Been in my current role, which has sort of grown and developed over 13 years. And prior to that, I worked for a charity that ran children's homes and was a teacher within the children's homes. So
that's your background. You're a teaching professional.
Yeah, I was an English teacher originally in inner city London.
Wow.
Yeah, and didn't last as long as I'd planned, but had a looked after child actually in my form class, and I think it kind of opened my eyes to maybe another area where I could still use my teaching skills, but in a sort of a more directed way. And I'd seen an advert for a tutor for this charity that ran the children's homes. And then a full-time job came along and I got it and found my niche, found my thing.
Your thing?
Yeah.
Because you wrote a blog for me last year and it was really popular. It was about around behaviour and behaviour in classrooms specifically. And it was clear that it was something you're really passionate about. Is it a passion or is it a job or a vocation or a calling?
I'm not sure I believe in callings, but I definitely, it's something that I am very passionate about. And I think I've always been a bit of a fighter.
Right.
And I think this is something worth fighting for. So for me, it's a bit of an honour, really, to be in a position where I can come to work every day and, fight on behalf of some of the most worthwhile children that there are, to try and make things better for them. And
that's really interesting, because I know you're
you're about to take on another role, aren't you? So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we've set up the National Association of Virtual School Heads last year.
Yeah.
Keep pinching myself because we have only been real for just over 6 months. And it feels that in that time it's snowballed. We've kind of really, the profile's raised. Seems to have opened quite a few doors with Ofsted and the DfE and various charities. And it feels, with the Children's Social Work Bill sort of going through at the moment, that the role of the virtual school head has kind of been a bit in the spotlight. I'm currently vice chair and about to take on the chair's role of that organisation, which is, keep having to tell people we are volunteers, we have full-time jobs on top of this, but it's been brilliant, really enjoying it, and feels that it's heading in the right direction.
It is an interesting time because it's changed significantly over the last year, 2 years, 3 years, and before that. It was still there, but all of a sudden it's become much more higher on the spotlight. It's been spotlighted, or it's on the agenda. And do you think there's a reason for that? That all of a sudden everyone's looking at virtual school heads.
I think we've had some personal experiences within the government that I think have obviously meant that those people who are making decisions have an interest in
right.
the area of looked after children, adopted children. And I think the virtual school head role has developed, and when it became statutory a couple of years ago, I think that obviously secured it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess it's kind of been about, okay, now it's secure as a role, how's it going to be used most effectively, and what's the impact it's going to have, and what does a good virtual school look like, and what does a good virtual school head do? So a lot of the work that we're doing nationally is around sort of we really want more research. So we're, as a charity, we're there to kind of promote education sort of academic institutions
right.
to sort of direct their research more along these lines as
right.
well. So
what sort of things are you looking for them to focus on?
Well, attachment is obviously a big one.
Yeah.
So we're delighted that John Timpson's just put forward £750,000.
It's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, isn't it?
Yeah.
And together with the Rees Centre, who produced a really good report a couple of years ago, they're going to be sort of leading this work. But I think, Navish is certainly going to be there encouraging people to get involved so we can get much more evidence base around the
yeah.
impact of attachment and awareness within schools. So we'll be encouraging more schools to have the training and then be able to evaluate the impact that training has and see if schools have, when they have a better understanding of attachment, that actually it's easier to keep those children in school
benefits.
And also improve the outcomes. So hopefully it'll be very much focused on outcomes.
So that's quite an interesting. I hadn't realised you were a charity, the NAVA, National Association of Virtual School Heads. What did you call it? NVAC?
Navish.
Navish. I've called
like
it Navish.
Little cheeky imps, yeah.
The Navish.
Navishes.
That's interesting that it's not just a trade association. It's not a trade association.
No.
It's got almost a campaigning role and a research role and promoting. Well, that's a great overview of who you are and what you're doing. That's fantastic. Now to the stuff. Difficult question. Not difficult questions. When I thought about sort of speaking to you, you don't have to spend long on Twitter or Facebook or speak to many adoptive families or adopters or foster carers and school.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about school and the conversation ignites.
Mm.
That's the nicest way of saying it. Why do you think it's such a big deal for adopters and foster carers?
That's a big question.
That's an unfair question. Should I rephrase that?
School is fascinating because I think school is a universal service, and I think everybody has their own experience of school.
Mm.
And then as they go on to take on their new role, they then have a different experience of school. And each child that they have, they may have a different experience of school. Because
yeah.
I think what we know is that there's so much variation between schools. Some schools are fantastic, amazing. We've worked with schools who've got the attachment training, they've got TheraPlay, they've got open door policies, so if a child needs to
yeah.
see a particular member of staff, they can go whether they're teaching or not. They've got a real, you know, that emotional sort of connection with the children there. And then you have other schools where it's a one-size-fits-all approach. They can't change. They have this belief that, you know, perhaps if they don't do it this way, that the whole system's going to fall apart, or Ofsted's going to come in and criticise them. And we know, you know, schools are under an awful lot of pressure. And we're very much there to kind of support schools. You know, we're there. It's a very, you know, the virtual school head has to kind of support and challenge. So it's kind of trying to get that balance right. But, you know.
I mean, that is a really interesting balance, isn't it? Because you can lead a horse to water, but a pencil must be led. To quote Laurel and Hardy, I'm not sure what relevance that is. But that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because you... What is your experience of working with schools? Do you get that mixed sort of response, or how do you find it? I'm drawing you on to thin ice, aren't I?
I think I've worked in my authority for a long time, and I think it's a lot easier when you're working with your own schools where, you know, I sit in the heads meetings, they know me as an individual. You know, we can have a conversation as almost equals. never
is
quite.
Is that, I mean, that's a key issue, isn't it, how they perceive you? Are you seen as a nuisance? Are you seen as a helping friend, a critical friend?
I think they know my role. They're very clear what my role is. And I think because of that, they would expect me to challenge. You know, that's because that's my job. At the same time, they know that if they need extra funding to support a child, we usually provide it. If they need extra support for a child, we can usually provide it. So I think it's about our offer to schools is part of the deal. You know,
you
so
hold the pupil premium, don't you?
We do. That's been amazing. It's made a real difference. I mean, as a national association, it's something we've been trying to get a bit more information on, because what a lot of schools say is that all different virtual school heads manage it differently.
Right.
And there are some, very few now, who give all the money to schools, a handful that give none of the money to schools, and then there's kind of a group in the middle that kind of do, you know, a certain amount to schools, hold a certain amount back, or it will be dependent on what's on the personal education plan. It will be, you know, whatever the school asks for, generally. Our model is we retain some centrally to provide additional resources, such as educational psychologist, counsellor. We've got an apprentice care leaver who's a teaching assistant. We've funded a reading recovery teacher, because we know that's an approach that can really make a difference. And if children can't read, then the rest of the curriculum is not accessible. So we've kind of used our pupil premium to kind of build up those resources that we know are going to make the biggest difference to our children. But then schools get a pot of money as well. Yeah. They get a proportion of it, which they can use how they choose.
So when you say our children, you're talking primarily about looked after children.
Yeah, looked after children, because, of course, the money for the adopted children all goes straight to schools. And I think...
I'm tempted to ask you what you think of that, but I don't want to court controversy. I mean, do you think that system is working, or could it be improved? Or
I think it's a difficult one, because our conference this year, we invited some adoptive parents along to, had some foster carers, schools there, social workers. It was a good, you know, we had a lot of discussion at our conference this year. And I think it's hard, because I think most of the conversations I have with adopters are around pupil premium and them not feeling that school are using it appropriately. Now, I say, well, the alternative is, if you had a model like mine, school would get less of the money. But, you know, we it's very much based on individual needs. So I have some looked after children that require very expensive bespoke packages. So they might get more than another child.
Yeah.
And I think because I've got a corporate parenting role for those children, it's very different.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for an adopter, they're the parent. And I don't think schools would want the money going to the adopters, which would be the equivalent of it coming to me, I guess.
Yeah, of course.
So I think I'm happy to kind of be there to sort of challenge schools, because I think the other thing with the money for adopted children is that it's a self-declaration. So I think there's something there. You know, if a parent, an adopter has come forward, or someone, an SGO has come forward and said, actually, I'd like you to claim the money for my child, I do think there's something in there that suggests that there needs to be some conversation about how that money would best be used. And I think we're really keen to make sure schools for all children who get pupil premium and pupil premium plus, is that it's an individualised approach, because it's not a one-size-fits-all model. And
I mean, the worst-case scenarios that I've heard of trips being funded for classes, but then the child, because of their behaviour, being excluded, but the money that they, you know, the money that was allocated to them has been used to support the trip, and that's the doomsday scenario.
Yeah.
Do you think that, because we're still sort of learning about how you are supporting adoptive parents, have you had adoptive parents sort of come to you, or is that, do they know about that?
Yeah, had a few, yes.
And is that, do you see yourself as an advisory role, or just a, perhaps a kind of a, someone who can add weight to an argument?
I think this is going to be the challenge, because I think as virtual school heads, we're already really stretched. Mm-hmm. I have a very small team, you know, two teachers, you know, it's not a huge team. Lost an education welfare officer, lost drug and alcohol worker. So we're stretched already. And I think, I know that there's sort of, I think that managing the expectations is going to be hard, because virtual school heads generally want to help, kind of in our core. We kind of want to solve the problem. We want to help.
There's a reason you applied for that job.
Yeah. You know, and for Looked After Children, that's kind of what we do all day, every day. We're there trying to help and make things better. And I just worry that we haven't got the capacity, because if I got the figures, you know, it would double my capacity. If every adoptive parent wanted the same that I do for Looked After Children, I would need double the capacity. And so I think that's going to be the challenge. And I mean, I think virtual school heads, you know, feel that a lot of the work we do with schools will have a knock-on benefit.
Yeah.
So all the training that we offer and all the support that we offer and the conferences that we provide, the resources, the books, everything that we give to schools around, you know, our Looked After Children would benefit other children. So I think that's kind of where we're probably going to have the greatest impact. And also the work we're doing nationally in terms of finding out what works. You know, we want to know what makes the greatest difference for children who have experienced trauma and loss. And that's, you know, that's our challenge as a charity, is getting the answer to that question. And if we get more research in that area, again, that understanding is going to benefit those young, you know.
Yeah.
So I think for me, although it's good for us to be on the end of a phone and to offer that containment that sometimes people need, you know, a friendly voice, somebody who understands what it's like, because, you know, I have 300 children who, and a good proportion of those are the, you know, the worst kids in school kind of thing. So I know what it feels like to be trying to get, you know, to make that difference to those children.
You're used to those conversations.
Yeah.
And the difficult conversations around behaviour versus the reasons behind that behaviour, and you know, trying to reflect that back on the school.
Completely.
What are you doing to help that behaviour? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then the different responses, because, as you say, some schools are, well, this are the rules, and that's that.
Yeah, but it's things like, you know, how are you using your support staff? You know, because actually, if you use them slightly differently, you could have a really big impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole stuff around having key adults and key teams, and actually it doesn't need, you maybe you need to think differently about having somebody sat next to a child in every lesson, when actually what they need is a drop-in. They need somebody there as and when it's needed.
Door,
they need somebody who can wander around and check in and let them know they, you know, somebody's there keeping an eye on things and that they're safe. And they're the things that a child needs. Well, actually, you can have one person doing that for 10 kids, but not actually sitting next to them.
Yeah.
And I think it's about, you know, and schools are really struggling financially, and it's helping them see that it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. You know, you can get training for free from virtual school heads usually. You can, you know, we can set up systems that can help meet the needs of a particular child. We can, you know, we can offer educational psychologists who can, you know, offer solution orientated meetings with school staff and actually start to change the perception around a child, and they're not big costs, but they can make a big difference.
They can have a huge impact.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, I'm speaking to the wrong virtual school head, aren't I? Because you are clearly very passionate about this. And that,
most virtual school heads are very passionate.
I guess it's like anything. If you get 100 people in the room, so there's a range of experiences and a range of knowledge and a range of motivations. And I have a friend who's a virtual school head, and she had a really frank conversation with me one day, and she said, "I am the corporate parent." And it took me a while to really click what she was saying. She said, and she worries about them, and she comes in, and she's often said, "I know the names of every child in each of the schools." I can't remember what my original point was, but I think that it is a passion of yours, clearly. How do you find that training role, and what are your thoughts around teacher training? And I'm opening up a huge area potentially, but do you think that, you know, around child development, around mm-hmm. impact of loss, trauma, separation mm-hmm. on children, is that something that should be put in day one teacher training school?
Yes, and we managed to get it in. I think the nice thing about being a national association now is we're getting invited in to represent, you know, on various mm-hmm. DfE groups. So we were involved in the Carter Review of Initial Teacher Training, and we did get a line in there about understanding developmental trauma and loss is in there. I think there's more to do in terms of, you know, actually what does that mean in terms of your classroom practice. I think we've got to do a lot more work for people to be recognising it. You know, and not, there's an awful lot, I think, of misdiagnosis around children with attachment needs and how it presents in a classroom. So there's a lot sort of a myth-busting, I think, that needs to be done. But I think a lot, you know, hopefully with this funding from John Timpson, we'll be able to get more of his little books out there, and we'll be able to get more of that message out there mm-hmm. Change perceptions. But I know I do session for our SCIT students here.
SCIT.
Oh God, I knew you were going to ask that. It's a school-based initial teacher training, right, I think, something like that. And it's, you know, for those who kind of work, they're sort of learning on the job kind of thing. So I do a session each year just sort of to do a bit about looked after children, a bit about attachment. I also go into schools and do a whole range of teaching, whether that's in a big secondary school, doing a whole staff briefing. Yeah. So that RE teacher that might see that child once a week knows, you know, can make the link between the behaviour and what's happened to that, might have happened to that child. We're really keen. I mean, I want to be doing a lot more work with schools when I'm chair. I think we've spent, this year was very much about kind of getting our name out there and making some links with some key organisations. And obviously with the Children's Social Work Bill going through, that's been a big focus of this year. Mm-hmm. But I think until we get schools on board, you know, we're going to really struggle. So that's about, you know, working with the unions, working with the multi-academy trust leads.
It's a big job for a voluntary role, isn't it?
Well, it is.
I mean, I find it really interesting. One of the things it really surprised me that even we talked about trauma and loss and all of those issues, but even just basic child development seems like it would be a key to know what is going on in a child at 3, 5, mm-hmm. 10, mm-hmm. 15. My experience of doing training with staff is the first time you do it, there's a light bulb moment, and you can see the light bulbs going on around. And I love it because your teachers, they get catch each other's eye and they go, "Johnny," you know, they whisper,
completely.
"Oh, it's Susie," or, you know, this one, that one. And so I think teachers didn't become teachers because they like doing paperwork, did they?
No.
They want to help.
Yeah.
That's their natural instinct, isn't it? I want to teach. I want to help children develop and be the best they can.
Yeah.
So, but often they often get, I mean, do you feel that there's a huge pressure on teachers at the moment? That's a leading question.
There is. Well, there is. And I think the curriculum, I mean, I'm a secondary trained teacher, and I seem to spend most of my time working with secondary schools, because that seems to be where more of the challenge is when you've got that sort of increased number of staff and just trying to apply a one-size-fits-all and lack, you know, consistency is really hard to manage in that kind of setup. primary schools seem to manage it a lot better.
Right.
And I think because you've got that a lot more one-to-one relationships, a lot less moving around, a lot less transitions, I think it's a lot easier for primary schools. But I do think at secondary school, the changes in the curriculum have made it even harder. So I think the pressure that schools are under in terms of getting outcomes, in terms of the requirements of the curriculum, what they've actually got to cover now, in terms of their teaching, I can understand how it can be frustrating if you've got one child in the classroom that's preventing you from doing that job.
Yeah.
But we know that if they understand attachment, there are some very simple strategies that can be used to really minimise that behaviour. And at the moment, we've got systems in schools that sometimes make the behaviour worse. So a child who's experienced in shame and carries around shame with them, the minute their name's put on the board as a warning, that then triggers a much bigger response, you know, and they then respond to that response instinctively because they feel threatened, and then it kind of escalates from there. So we get children who have maybe done something really minor ending up getting
excluded.
Yeah, basically.
Well, yeah.
So it's kind of completely disproportionate. So we're kind of trying to get schools to see that and to recognise that and be a bit more reflective and say it's okay to do things differently for these children because they need it. And, you know,
you're not being soft.
Yeah. No, and actually this is to get them to a point where they can operate in that system.
Yeah.
But at the moment they can't, you know, and it needs this kind of work needs to happen before they're going to be there. Because they've got these gaps in their development, you know, which is preventing them from being there. And, you know, this idea that you can't be independent until you've had a chance to be dependent.
Yeah.
And I think particularly in secondary schools, they really struggle with that.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of treating a 14-year-old like you would a 7-year-old, but actually that's often the developmental age that that child's operating at and they need to do that.
That's a really complex
issue,
isn't it?
Huge.
And for children who... It's an overwhelming experience, isn't it? Being dropped into a high school or comprehensive where you're expected to be something that perhaps you just aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you're on the wrong side of the tracks, so you're out of the out of the grooves and it all unravels, really. I did have another question about education healthcare plans, which is another... which seemed a lot of people... seek them for their children, and often then their children who perhaps they don't have learning disabilities or they don't have a physical disability, but actually it's an emotional developmental issue, but really struggle to kind of get that through. Where do you stand on?
Well, I struggle to get that through.
Right, okay. Well,
I think we've noticed the numbers of looked after children with an EHCP or a statement has declined quite considerably because I think funding arrangements change, so first 10 hours or 15 depending on where you're living goes to schools, and and actually you would only expect to go through to that next level if that child needed a specialist provision or more than that
basic.
And I think what we find is that usually most of schools, you know, with a bit of advice and support can manage that. So actually we would expect to see that change because the thresholds, I guess, have changed. And I think the challenge is where you've got children with social, emotional, mental health needs and recognising that within the code of practice. So quite often I'll go into a school and they'll reel out a list of misdemeanours that the child has done. They print out whatever's in their behaviour system. And I'll be like, right, okay, so I take it this child has some social, emotional, mental health difficulties.
That's an underlying issue.
Is your SENCO aware of this? And quite often the case is no. I was like, well, if this is what's presenting and this is the barrier to learning, then your SENCO needs to be aware and you need to be providing that child with support. And it's not necessarily the EHCP because I think that's a lot clearer because I think it is, right, if that child isn't managing with what the school's got and the school haven't got any more resources, then you need to go to that next level.
Yeah.
or if they need something specialist, you need to go to that. I think that that's much clearer.
Yeah.
But it's that school support, that SEN support group, that I think the SEMH often gets missed. So then the behaviour escalates, whereas actually if it was dealt with at that lower level, if the support was used differently,
yeah,
then it might stop, not need that escalation.
Because
so
often we're talking about simple fixes, aren't we?
Yeah.
And cheap fixes.
Yeah.
Even to the point of where a child sits in a room.
Completely.
But because the behaviour's escalated, or the behaviour's they've become a problem, then the people are looking for bigger solutions to what are simple problems, potentially. And of course, there are some children who need an awful lot of support as well. I'm thinking, you know, there's a whole gamut of stuff. And I do see that time and time again, even yesterday, I was looking at Facebook and a friend was sort of, you know, how shall I say, sharing their thoughts on professionals. I'm being polite. And it is just such a challenge for so many parents. And it's paradigm. Education is a different paradigm. It's how you think about children. It's different to how social workers think about children. And do you see your training role as kind of trying to break down those barriers between families and children and children and social care and doctors and big
dads? I mean, the most powerful training I have up my sleeve isn't delivered by me. It's delivered by our Children in Care Council. And they've developed a training program called Care For Me.
Right.
And they go round to schools and deliver that training about what it feels like to be in the care system. And they do some little activities that help put teachers and school staff in the shoes of a child who's experienced care. And that is really powerful. And I think once you've got the hearts, minds of staff, it makes it so much easier for me to then go in.
You come in with the science.
And with the solutions and with, you know, so actually they're like, yeah, no, we do want to get it right for these kids because it's really important we get it right for these kids. And once you've got that, I think that's where you kind of can then do the work. I think the voice of young people is the key. And I think often I find as well, once you talk, you know, the staff will be like, what? We don't know what's going on here. They keep doing. I say, have you actually spoken to the young person? And often they haven't, you know, and the minute you do, you get a very clear answer, you know, that the kids themselves know what the problem is and what needs to be done about it. So the solution is often there.
Under your nose.
Yeah, and I think it's just, you know, sometimes we need to kind of rethink how we approach young people.
Yes, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Mm.
That would be good. Well, I'm aware I've taken up half an hour of your time. I have one last question. What does the future hold?
All of it.
For education and children, do you think that if we came back and had this conversation in 10 years' time, do you think that we would have our behaviour management models would have altered? Is that?
I think it'll have to.
Right.
I think this. I mean, I'm a terrible optimist. I couldn't do this job if I wasn't. I think you always have to hope that the work that you're doing is going to alter mindsets. And I think, you know, one of the things that we, as a national association, worked with Ofsted on was around this kind of, you know, stop judging our kids against all kids. You know, it's not fair. And actually, there it was in the annual social care report. You know, it is not fair to compare looked after children who have experienced developmental trauma and loss with their peers who have had stable, happy lives.
That's a result.
That's change happening right in front of us. You know, that's brilliant.
It's amazing.
And school Ofsted, you know, now they're kind of saying, well, you know, if a school's got 40 children in detention, their behaviour system isn't working. Brilliant. That's what I want to hear.
Yeah.
That's what schools need to hear, because actually this approach that they're using, which is constantly punishing children, and I worry that it's taking away the relationship with staff.
Yeah.
When I was in a classroom, I didn't have these wonderful systems. I just had to work on relationships and actually building relationships with young people so that when they came into the classroom, they wanted to learn because they were invested in the ethos of the classroom and the relationships within the classroom.
Yeah.
And I worry that we're de-skilling a lot of teachers at the moment by taking away that responsibility to kind of build a relationship with a young person and be able to communicate in a way that they will cooperate, you know, more effectively.
That's really interesting, that idea of, because often when I speak to teachers, I've got friends who are teachers, and their job is not what I think is teaching. There's so much recording and measuring,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there's a lot of looking at tables, and but actually teaching, to my mind, is sitting in front of people. It, like you say, it's relational.
Mm-hmm.
If children are interested in teachers,
mm-hmm.
they're interested in what they've got to
mm-hmm.
say. If
completely.
They feel like the teacher values them, then they'll listen to them.
Completely.
My best subject at school was by the teacher I liked the most.
Yeah, completely.
You know, it's not rocket science.
No.
And vice versa as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, that's really interesting that you're hoping to have an influence on Ofsted, that the pendulum would swing back towards relationship. And
yeah, I think that's where it needs to be. And actually, I think because we've now got this section in the framework, school framework, around wellbeing is in there now. So actually, that there is scope to kind of look at that. But also for me, since the Rees Centre report that was published a couple of years ago, stability came out of that as a biggie, and mainstream school came out of that as a biggie.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, what I want for majority of my looked after children is that they succeed in a mainstream school and they experience stability in school.
Yeah.
Because I then know that the chances of them getting some good GCSEs is going to be increased. As it stands at the moment, I have far too many in alternative provision, far too many changes. They tend to be the ones that come into care late. So I think, as well, I've started thinking very much in terms of there's two different cohorts we have. We have our long-term looked after children that we have right through from when they're little primary school children through to hopefully university or whatever. The job apprenticeships are going really well at the moment, I have to say. And then we have these that come in very late as teenagers who have had so much disruption and so much instability, and, you know, their needs haven't been addressed. And, you know, the data, the DFA are now publishing children in need data.
Mm-hmm.
So those ones on the edge of care, their outcomes are even worse than looked after children. Looked after children's worse than adopted children. So we know adopters are doing something right, because actually, although the outcomes are poor, they're better. So we know, you know, there's something about the system that is working. And I think if we can do more to make the, you know, the mainstream system better, then hopefully more, you know, we'll see greater improvements across the board. That's my wish for the future.
For the future. Hey, well, it's been fantastic to speak to you. Thank you very much. And I wish you all the best for the association. Can you tell us if there's anything we can do, I can do? Do you have a website that we can look at? And
we do have a website.
Caught you on the hoof. What's the website?
It's navish.org.uk.
And are there resources there that people can?
They are. It's work in progress.
Right.
And it's landed on me.
All right. Okay, so it's your work in progress. Yes.
My work in progress.
You're adding coding to your list. But also there's the Twitter.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I see snippets and articles and things. And that's at Navish.
Navish underscore UK.
_UK.
Because we're going international, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
We do actually have somebody from Australia coming to our conference. They are looking at setting up virtual school model over in Melbourne.
When is your conference?
In March.
Right. That's right. I have a feeling that my friend Scott is speaking it.
Yes.
He's my co-host. When you see him, don't be nice to him, be horrible to him. Kick him in the shins from me. No, I don't, he's serious. Well, Jane, thank you very much for speaking to me. It's much appreciated, and I wish you all success with your future hopes and aspirations.
Thank you.
So there you go. That was the interview with Jane, and I found her to be incredibly passionate, which was just so encouraging to find someone who was genuinely so bothered about kids and all of that kind of stuff. It was fantastic. What did you think of that then?
Well, the one thing that struck me was actually because school education, whether it be when I was at school or when I was a lad or with my children being at school, the kind of head teacher title, I always have kind of this vision of the of kind of someone with stature and, you know, But I think that actually, don't get me wrong, she has got, you know, a presence and what have you, but I just think that she came over as human. And I think that's unusual, I think, to kind of relate to somebody. You're right. She's just so passionate about children, education, and, you know, her background. She's not just been a head teacher. She's done lots of different things, which I think is really key. She's witnessed life before becoming either a virtual school head or, you know, the incoming chair.
Yeah, it kind of gives you hope that there's good people out there. And it's so often, I think teachers, it's not combative, but we can get into this idea of adoption versus the world. But there's people on our side.
Yeah.
Good people.
And so it was exactly a
fantastically interesting. And I think before we were talking and you mentioned, you know, the fact that this is a voluntary role, you know, she works full time and then she's doing this on top of that.
I know. And I didn't think that of Knavish. I like the name Knavish as well. It's very punchy. But I assumed, because they just all became live on Twitter and they really engage very well on Twitter, I have to say. And they engage in a supportive way as well. And they will challenge and they will, you know, appear to want to advocate as well. And I just assumed that they had a little person who was doing all their social media who was paid, you know, a lot of money, and to find out that they are a charity and they do it in the way that they do it as well as a day job, I just think it's proof in itself that they're taking it seriously as well.
Yeah.
So it's not just the government has said that we need to start doing more for, you know, or the government will say, or however it's going to work, I don't know when that comes through, but they're not, you know, it's not them just saying, well, we have to do this. They actually want to do it. Somebody's actually said, why don't we do this? And I think that's truly and hugely important to us as parents, as well as, you know, the carers and parents have looked after children. But, you know, it's just, I don't know, I've put them on, I had them in a certain place and now I've got them a little bit higher up the kind of scale in my eyes.
Yeah. I mean, I've got another friend who's a virtual school head for London Borough and, just an incredibly passionate woman. And I think often what we strive for is partnerships, finding people who we can partner with. And, you know, probably like you, I find myself in a situation where I'm advocating for my children or daughter or son or whatever. And they're people who are bothered. They're people who became...
Yeah.
In that case, a virtual school head, but you know, social workers. Very few social workers can become social workers because they're like upsetting people.
A calling.
Yeah.
Apart from you, but yeah, I mean, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's a calling, isn't it? It is a calling. And I mean, you know, you've name dropped it, you know, a virtual school head. I know a virtual school head as well. And
you're just saying that because I'm
so passionate about what they do. No, I do, and this lady works in Peterborough, so no. But she's very passionate about what she does as well. And she's very open to kind of that working together, you know. And I think it was actually because I used to sit on an adoption panel with her, and she always told me. She said, you know, bearing in mind we'd had two children when I worked with her, but since. And I've learned from something that she told me, and that was, you know, when you're looking at schools for children who are looked after or previously looked after or adopted or, you know, whatever, never ever look at kind of outstanding schools. I mean, look at them by all means, but don't, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket and think, well, that's outstanding. So you're brilliant at everything. And that was, I mean, this was 5-6 years ago, so you know, we're talking a while ago, but, you know, that stuck with me. And I share that wherever I go, especially with new. Struggling to kind of connect with schools and things like that. And I always give them that little bit of advice that, you know, by all means, go and look at that school that's 2 minutes from your door that's outside. Don't write off the one that's, you know, maybe a mile away just because. And that's the kind of advice that I've had from virtual school heads.
Yeah, I think that they are a really good resource. And even just for that sort of stuff, knowing, you know, the shiny, bright, newly built school doesn't, it's a nice building, but you choose, you choose people, not buildings. Who said it to me was you choose the staff when you're looking at schools, and that's always bore fruit. I mean, a long time ago, my daughter, she's 23 now, but she was in a school, and she, within weeks, she was floundering. And a friend said, try this school down the road. And it was a school that was kind of, it was ramshackle. I mean, I'm not saying that in the nicest terms, it was ramshackle. But we went in, and the head teacher walked us round, and she said, as she walked round, every room she walked into, every child looked at it and smiled out of, it's Miss Penny.
Mm.
And she knew the name of every child in the school, and we didn't have to ask any questions. She thought, the children are happy here. And, you know, that's a, I guess we're off a little bit off topic, but it's that passion we're after.
But it's relevant. It's relevant, I don't think that's different. I know that you're waiting on some news this week about schools, and we've had our news about schools for our little man for high school.
Oh, we got our news.
And
we got in where we wanted
to
go.
Oh, you did get it. Fantastic. That's excellent news. Well, can you tell us the seat update as on the World Wide Web?
Well, I'll be honest, it's not the school. I mean, if I'm being totally honest, it's not the school I would send any child to, but our lives are complicated. It's a school for cookie cutter children, if there is such a thing. And the other element is that it's, you know, it's close. And it ticks a lot of boxes. So you're weighing things up, aren't you, all the time?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the high school that our little man will go to is it's 7 miles away. But we have one 200 metres from our back door, high school. And it's just very sad that they would not be able to provide the care and the needs, you know, they wouldn't be able to provide for his needs. And we know that, and we were very honest with the school, and we know them of old because the two older boys went there, and that's why we had to make that decision. So we've now got a 14-mile round trip twice a day, but it's for the greater good because he would have lasted a week at the other school.
Yeah.
And that's not fair. I don't want to put him through that. So, you know, it's that sort of thing that you'll learn from a virtual school. But I'm also interested in the kind of future of the virtual school function in terms of EHCPs, and you know, you and I know a number of people who have been struggling with that recently.
Yeah.
And how supportive that's going to be, and I guess that's the kind of unknown of this new situation that the virtual schools find themselves in, to cope with the kind of rise in numbers for the virtual schools. And of course, we don't know how it's going to work yet, do we? We don't know
at all. Yeah, absolutely.
The rules are going to be for the adopted children. So.
Yeah. And I guess people have built individual relationships with the virtual school heads, but I think what that moment it becomes a thing, we'll see how it works. And undoubtedly, there will be an element of people, there will be less good virtual school heads, unfortunately.
Yeah, of course so. Yeah. And I guess that's the one thing about the community. We'll always hear about the bad ones before we hear about the very good ones.
Yeah, I am smiling as we're having this conversation because, as it turns out, Jane Pickthall is my daughter's school's virtual school head. How jammy is that?
Oh, lucky.
Yeah, lucky.
Lucky.
Yeah. Lego's the tone again.
Can we all have a piece of them? Well, I'm going to meet her next. Week after next anyway, I think.
Are you?
I'm going to the conference via my work to go along and talk about, I'm not sure what I'm going to talk about now, so it'd be unfair for me to say, but I'm going to be talking about something along the lines of the needs of adopted children and parents through the virtual school head, because they've obviously got, you know, some time until all goes through. Yeah, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, whatever it's called. Is it white paper? I can't remember what they call it.
I believe it is a white paper, yes.
I'm not very politic, So, yeah, but I'm going to talk at the conference. And interestingly, I will be there and I will be on before the Australian virtual school head from Melbourne. So she was talking about the Melbourne.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're not listening when you were talking to her.
No, I was listening. I was.
They're going to be doing a talk after my talk on their plan for virtual school heads in Australia or in Melbourne specifically. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about that.
Be interesting, because they've got quite a comparable system in Australia to England and Wales. Not identical, but a lot of similarities. But they're, when I read a bit about them, very innovative across the board around their social care and stuff, just a bit more than we are, perhaps. It's a different context. Be interested to find out. So you're speaking there. That's exciting, isn't it? Are you speaking first in the day?
I'm about 11 o'clock, I think.
Oh. Whatever you do, always try and get on first, and then you don't spend the day worrying that everyone's better than you.
Do you know what? I'm going to be in so many places that week. I will be rocking up probably 20 minutes before I'm due to speak, going on and then leaving. That's how busy that week is.
That is so cool,
I'm not
going
to have time to think about it. I know, that is...
I'll let Jane know, so when she's trying to kick your shin, she catches you.
Yeah, that's a busy week that week. So, I will not be able to spend too much time there, sadly. But I am going to definitely be listening for the virtual school in Melbourne, most definitely.
Excellent. Anything else you're up to? Exciting days in your life?
Yeah, this next couple of weeks is, again, it's just all so busy. So we've got the GFE next week.
I will see you there.
You will see me there. And then I have to rush off after that to do the Voice in the Million concert.
What's that?
It's basically a school's concert. So school choirs come along, schools get to take part. It's in Wembley Arena. So
I'm losing interest. You're going to one in a million. I'm sure it'll be exciting.
Yeah. I know, yeah. Voice in a Million. Voice in a Million.
What Voice in a Million?
The nice thing about Voice in a Million is that the little one and one of my colleagues' little ones get to lead the parade on stage. So we get to walk on the stage at Wembley in front of all those people. So that's quite a nice thing. So, yes. Then, like I said, the next week is the week after. Yeah. And then I've got, lots of things going on. So I'm all around England again. All around. But not up. Yeah,
my life is dull and mundane by comparison.
Well, you need to apply for a new job. That's what you need to do. Something to keep you busy. So let me think. Where's there a vacancy somewhere?
McDonald's are taking on. I'm not. Honestly, you're just so funny. I'm not as busy as you, but we are working on the last paper.
It could be
our parent violence paper, tinkering away, and then I've been asked to present that to the DfE. And all kinds of thoughts, me and Dr. T are pondering away that. So that's exciting. And it's kind of chipping away. Just keep pushing and see what we can come up with.
Yeah, well, you know what they say, slowly, slowly, catch your monkey.
Exactly. And then I believe the next podcast we do, you're going to do the interviews. That's exciting, isn't it?
I know. How exciting is that?
That's exciting. And then after that, I thought it would be Mother's Day.
You're told.
No. So it's Mother's Day after that.
Yes, it will be, yes.
And so I thought we'd get some mothers on.
I think that's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, there's even talk of me letting the good Mrs. C take the reins.
Oh.
That's a bit scary.
Give her a bottle of wine and let her go on with it. That's what I say.
Yeah, start her own podcast. Blummin' egg. Anyway, don't go there.
Yeah, I think we've got enough of one. Oh, bless her.
Bless her heart. Right. Well, I'm going to say goodbye to you. It's been great to talk to you, and I hope you have a good weekend and week and everything. The wind is on your back, and all your cycling is downhill.
Yes, all that.
Okay.
Yes. We shall see. Have a good one, Al.
And you. Bye bye. Hello, and welcome to the 11th episode. What you keep talking when I'm talking.
You should put this out. People would find it hilarious.
This is deeply unprofessional. How on earth do you expect us to beat the other podcasts out there? This is shocking.
Look, it's not radio. That's the next thing is radio. We need to do radio. Anyway, go on. Right, I'm shutting up now.
Radio adoption. That'd be wonderful. Excellent.